Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks, and you join us shortly after Iran has launched a major missile attack on Israel. It was just over 3 hours ago that the alert went out, air raid sirens sounding across much of the country. This was the sound captured in Israel's biggest city, Tel Aviv, as people raced for shelters. Within just a few minutes, as missiles streaked across the Israeli sky, a distinctive orange flare from their tails, Israel's own air defence launched its ballistic interception system. It's difficult to tell from those explosions whether they were mid-air interceptions or whether they were of impacts on the ground from the incoming ballistic missiles launched by Iran. But we do know that there were impacts on the ground. What we do know is that, as the Israeli military has said, some of the 180 missiles did have hits. The Israeli military has also said it will respond powerfully tonight. Iran has carried out a serious act and is pushing the Middle East to an escalation. Tonight's event will have consequences, said the Israeli military spokesman Daniel Hagari. Well, we often hear from Gershon Baskin, an Israeli hostage negotiator on NewsHour. Just after the missiles were fired, he spoke to the BBC from a bomb shelter in Jerusalem.
I'm in West Jerusalem, sitting in the bomb shelter of our house. There were emergency warnings to go to bomb shelters about 15 minutes ago. Over the last minutes, we've heard nonstop booming over our heads in Jerusalem. From what we hear on the Israeli news, it's probably the anti-rockets that are hitting missiles coming in from Iran. Right now, basically, the whole country of Israel is in their bomb shelters. I must say, listening to the names of the towns and the cities that are getting warnings, that we're also hearing the names of Palestinian towns and cities, both inside of Israel and in the occupied West Bank. So the Iranian rockets and missiles don't discriminate between Israelis and Palestinians here. We're all targeted now from Iran.
Well, all of this, of course, happened on the day that Israel confirmed that it had begun what it called limited targeted ground operations inside Lebanon. In other words, the beginning, however, initially small scale of an invasion. And we'll hear later in the programme from a southern Lebanese resident, one of the million who has been displaced. He just today made the decision to flee his village for Beirut. In the past hour, the US National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan has been speaking at the White House.
Today, Iran launched nearly 200 ballistic missiles towards targets in Israel. The United States military coordinated closely with the Israeli Defense Forces to help defend Israel against this attack. U.S. naval destroyers joined Israeli air defense units in firing interceptors to shoot down inbound missiles. President Biden and Vice President Harris monitored the attack and the response from the White House Situation Room, joined in person and remotely by their national security team. We are still working with the IDF and the authorities in Israel to assess the impact of the attack. But at this time, and I stress at this time, we do not know of any deaths in Israel.
We'll pick up on the U.S. response in just a moment. But shortly before we came on air, I spoke to the international spokesman for the Israel Defense Forces, Lieutenant Colonel Nadav Shoshani, and he gave me his assessment of the Iranian missile attack.
Around 7:30 Israeli time, local time, Iran launched a large scale, one of the largest attacks in the history of the state of Israel, firing approximately, maybe more, we are still assessing the situation, but approximately 180 ballistic missiles towards Israel. Each one of these missiles has hundreds of kilograms of explosive in their warhead. One missile is enough to blow up a large building. They fired 180 of those towards Israel, essentially sending all of Israel, except very small parts in north and south, to bomb shelters. Approximately 10 million Israelis have run into bomb shelters this evening because of this very long and aggressive attack by the Iranian regime towards Israel, firing these heavy ballistic missiles indiscriminately, just all around Israel, hitting different locations, schools, civilians.
Well, you say hitting, hang on, hitting schools and civilians. I mean, what is your assessment of damage?
Well, there is damage to buildings in several locations in central Israel and in southern Israel. At the moment, we can say that the casualty count is low, but mostly because of our aerial defense systems and because of the civilians listening to the Home Front Command guidelines. Basically staying in the bomb shelters for an hour or two, hiding from those missiles. So far, and we're still assessing the situation as we're speaking, you know, this is very recent news. There are several injured civilians from this attack. There is one civilian that is killed from this attack.
And that was where?
In the area of Jericho. From the information we have at the moment, again, this is very early and we're still assessing with the situation.
Right. And so just to be clear for our listeners around the world, Jericho is part of the occupied territories. And the chances are, in that case, if it were a fatality in Jericho, it was that of a Palestinian.
That is our understanding, is that it was a Palestinian, but it doesn't matter. It's an Iranians killed civilians. Their goal was to kill many more civilians, but luckily the civilians, 10 million of them, ran to bomb shelters and stayed there until the attack was over. And our aerial defense systems were able to thwart most of those missiles, but not all of them.
And you say your aerial defense systems. Are you able to tell us whether there was any direct help from allies, in particular the United States, in intercepting the missiles?
We've seen this on April 14th. This isn't the first time that the Iranian regime has attacked Israel directly. And also on this case, we had support from our allies.
Can you tell me what sort of support?
Defending our borders. And in this case, I can say that the U.S., the Central Command Air Force, and other forces took part in this defense operation to thwart this very, very large terror attack by the Iranians.
And that was Lieutenant Colonel Nadav Shoshani from the Israel Defense Forces. Tom Bateman is our U.S. State Department correspondent, joins us from Washington. Tom, the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, I saw, described the attack from the Iranians as basically ineffective because of Israel's ability, presumably with American help, to thwart most of the missiles. What do you think the Americans are telling the Israelis tonight, or encouraging the Israelis tonight, to do in terms of calibrating their response?
Well, that's a question that we've just been asking the State Department spokesman, Matthew Miller, at a news briefing in the last hour. You know, I was one among a number of journalists pushing him on that particular point, because remember, in the hours before this, and this has all unfolded extremely rapidly, back in April, there were days of waiting anticipation because the Iranians had telegraphed this. U.S. intelligence were picking up their maneuvers and going public with that. This time, this is all unfolded extremely quickly. And part of that moment was that the White House was making it clear that they believed this was coming. It was imminent, but also far stronger in their warnings to Iran than they were back in April, because this time they have said that any direct military attack on Israel by the Iranians would be met with, they said, severe consequences. Now, what will those severe consequences be? Jake Sullivan, the White House National Security Advisor, was asked that question. He said, we're talking to our Israelis to make sure that that will happen. So they're still talking about this. And as I say, here at the State Department, I mean, we pressed the spokesman repeatedly on this. All he would say is that they are now involved in deep discussions and consultations with their Israeli partners, as he put it, and that is now what is being talked about. He said at the same moment that they've always taken an approach throughout the last year that the Americans have wanted to sort of work with a combination of deterrence and diplomacy, he said. And I pressed him on that. I mean, is diplomacy going to be any part of this in the terms of the way they respond to the Iranians? And he said, yes, basically, it's still part of it, but they're going to use this combination again of deterrence and diplomacy. But I think they've, you know, made it clear, and it would be very hard to see how they go back on a warning like that that uses the word severe consequences, you know, without being seen to follow through on that. Particularly given that there are voices already in Israel saying part of the problem, as far as they're concerned, is that they didn't retaliate forcefully enough last time back in April. So I think, you know, everyone, all eyes now are on what the Israelis do with American backing.
And do you get a sense in the US that there is, whilst there may be acceptance and indeed perhaps even understanding and encouragement for Israel to hit the Iranians back, do you get any sense that there is nervousness in Washington as to where this may end up?
There's a massive amount of concern and nervousness both within the administration and outside it. Because remember where we were just a week ago, you know, when we were talking at the United Nations in New York, the US was leading a big diplomatic push involving its key European allies, its key allies in the Middle East, that came out with a joint statement calling on both Israel and Hezbollah to back down, to, you know, come down from the brink, to get back involved in mediated negotiations. Basically, this was a call for restraint. And within the space of a few short days, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli leader, showed up in New York, gave a speech in which he made absolutely no mention of this ceasefire proposal at all, and instead, from his New York hotel room, authorized the killing of Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah. So that was the Israeli response to the US call for diplomacy, basically. And here we are now with the US having to back its ally and having to back the fact that they assassinated Hassan Nasrallah and also everything associated with that and what we've seen taking place in Lebanon over the course of the last week or two, but at the same time, extremely concerned. And I think it's no surprise that, you know, the Americans, I mean, Matthew Miller, the spokesman, just said, and I don't think I've heard him say this before, that they basically concede that the Israelis have, in their words, expanded the conflict. He won't accuse them of escalating it, but they know pretty clearly that they're not in the place they wanted to be last week. And the reason for that is the very thing that they've wanted to avoid is now a step closer, which is the potential for a wider regional war, and their ultimate nightmare scenario, which is the potential for direct US-Iranian confrontation in the Middle East.
Our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman, thank you very much for bringing us the latest from Washington. Much more to come here on NewsHour. And among the voices we will be hearing from is a Lebanese resident who lives near the southern border with Israel. He tells us why he decided just today to flee his home.
This is the first time we feel that it got very serious in our village. And the first time we get a hit from aircraft right inside our village. There were a family killed. And also the priest of our village, also he was wounded, seriously wounded, along with all his family.
That interview coming up in about 15 minutes. Our headlines this hour: Iran has launched a barrage of missiles into Israel, and the Israeli military spokesman Daniel Hagari has said that the Israeli Air Force will, in his words, strike powerfully in the Middle East tonight. You're with the BBC World Service and live from London NewsHour with me, Tim Franks. Let's hear what Iran has had to say about events then. Well, the Iranian president, Masoud Pezeshkian, put it in a social media post saying, this is just part of our capability, talking about that barrage of ballistic missiles aimed at Israel. Do not get into a confrontation with Iran, he said. Professor Mohammad Mirandi is an Iranian academic close to the government in Tehran and their thinking. He's currently in Beirut. He gave me his reaction to the Iranian missile strike.
It was a very limited attack. The Iranians have a far greater capability. It was in response to the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh, the head of the political head of Hamas in Tehran, which was a violation of Iranian sovereignty. And it was a response to the murder of the Iranian general in Beirut, the injury of the Iranian ambassador because of the beeper. His beeper exploded. And in addition to that, of course, it was in response to the murder of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah in Lebanon. And the Israelis, if they do strike back, the Iranians have promised an even more, a much more severe response.
Do you fear where this may lead? My guess is you will say that all this is justified because of what you've talked about in terms of the killings of the members of Hamas, the Revolutionary Guard commander Hassan Nasrallah and so forth. But do you fear that this could end up in a war which would be extremely damaging for Iran?
It would be more damaging for the UK than for Iran. If there is a war, if it expands, and the Americans, for example, get involved, then that would be the end of the oil and gas market. But if you mean between the Israeli regime and Iran, no, the Iranians can outgun the Israelis by far. Iran, ever since the invasion of Iraq, it has been developing and creating many underground missile and drone cities to defend the country against a potential American invasion. That is what has deterred the United States. Israel is a small regime that is not Iran's equal. It is a regime that needs the full support of the West. Iran is much more powerful. So with the resources that Iran has prepared for a potential war with the United States, Israel really is in no position to fight Iran.
Would you welcome a chance for there to be a major war against Israel in that case? I mean, obviously, Iran, since the revolution of 1979, has pitted itself very strongly against Israel. Successive leaders have called for Israel to be wiped from the map. Are you saying that this is, in a sense, a moment of clarity, that if the Israelis respond, as they have promised they will do, to this latest missile attack directly from Iran, that if there is a war that will redraw the map of the Middle East, that is one that you would welcome?
No, no one in the region wants war. That's why we've been holding back so much, despite all of the Israeli provocations. Everyone knows that the Israeli regime has been provoking Iran, and now it's carrying out genocide.
Okay, well, I mean, obviously, just on that point, if you don't mind, I don't want to relitigate the issue of genocide, which is being discussed at the International Court of Justice, but the Israelis profoundly disagree with that characterization of the war that they are carrying out in Gaza. I mean, it was just on that point, though. You say it was the Israelis who provoked all this. It was Hezbollah, which obviously is very closely linked to Iran, that started firing missiles into Israel on October the 8th.
No, not at all. This has been the Israeli regime that has been subjugating Palestinians in Gaza for decades. You know this as well as I. It is the Israeli regime that regularly kills people in the occupied West Bank, an occupied West Bank that even you acknowledge in the West that it's occupied illegally. The Israeli regime provokes day and night, and Hezbollah, Hamas, all they are saying is that ethno-supremacism, a chosen people, that's unacceptable. But somehow this language in the West is interpreted as outrageous, as anti-Semitic, and so we're not going to have the problem solved.
And the counter-argument is that whatever one may think about the nature of the occupation, the actions of the Israeli military and the Israeli government towards Palestinians, why should you decide that the lives of 80 million Iranians should, in a sense, be put onto the field of battle?
The Israeli regime has violated Iranian sovereignty. It has murdered a senior foreign dignitary in the capital of the country, the guest of the president of the Islamic Republic of Iran. The Israeli regime has bombed an Iranian embassy, killing everyone inside the building. The Israeli regime has murdered many Iranian scientists and military officers throughout the years, and Iran hasn't responded. Now the Iranians are saying enough is enough. So this is a deterrence. We already tried it once in April. We gave a limited strike to stop the Israelis. And what did the West do? You made fun of us. You said Iran does not have the capability to strike Israel. You encouraged the Israelis to do this again. So now Iran slapped the regime in the face and is telling the West, stop it.
And that was Professor Mohammed Mirandi, the Tehran-based academic. Well, with me through this hour is Azadeh Moaveni, a longtime Middle East watcher, now Professor of Journalism at New York University. Azadeh, we've only got a couple of minutes now. We'll certainly be getting more from you later in the programme. But just your assessment of how precarious a moment this is.
Well, it is terribly precarious. I mean, in the 25 years that I've covered the Middle East, I don't think we've been so much at the precipice. I do feel that even though it's a terrible and a very frightening night, that it does seem that Iran is not really seeking a wider war. It does seem to want to avoid that. The statements from the Iranian president that you just mentioned, sort of drawing a line under this, other statements by the Iranian mission to the UN using very sort of, we're drawing a line under this language, response duly carried out. I think Iran is really not in a position. I would disagree with Professor Mirandi. Iran cannot afford a wider war. We can maybe talk more about this later. Its economy is sinking. Its population does not support going to war over a war that is not seen as our war, an Iranian war. And so I hope that rational calculus prevails in what I hope will be an ending to the episode.
Yeah, but I mean, surely, I mean, as sure as night follows day, Israel will respond to this. I mean, if the Iranians are saying we want a line, or hinting they want a line drawn under this, the Israelis are going to completely ignore that line.
They most probably will, and I think the sense that an attack was imminent anyway was perhaps very likely part of why Iran decided to launch these missiles tonight. If they anticipated that Israel would be launching an attack against Iran, there was an indication on Monday, Benjamin Netanyahu made a televised address calling for regime change, addressing the Iranian people. All the signals were that an Israeli attack of some kind was coming anyway. And in that calculation, Tehran perhaps concluded, if they're going to come for us, we might as well try and dig back some of the lost respect, some of the lost face, by getting a small, serious attack in first.
Azadeh Moaveni, for the time being, thank you very much. We'll be returning to you later in the programme. You're listening to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC in London.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI for People.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
One of his HR team approached me and said, the chairman would like you to work in his office.
It was pretty quick that my gut instinct started to go, this is not right.
The only thing that he was interested in was touching my body.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. One of the worst famines in decades could soon take hold in Sudan following a year and a half of civil war. Already up to 150,000 people are believed to have died and millions more are displaced in what some aid organisations say is the worst humanitarian crisis facing the world today. Our Africa correspondent Barbara Plett-Usher sent this report from the city of Omdurman, just next to the capital Khartoum.
Hunger stalks Sudan. The youngest are its weakest prey. A doctor helps this thin little child in a hospital ward in Port Sudan, so full of malnourished babies their mothers have to share beds. Sudan has long seen malnutrition caused by poverty, but the civil war is causing famine in parts of the country.
When did your child get sick?
Last year.
Samia Musa tells me her two-year-old daughter has been sick for a month. But she also has other crises to deal with. Three of her four children are deaf. That's why she fled the war zone in the capital city. They felt the impact of the bombing and shelling, but they didn't know what was going on and they got really scared, she says. A few days later, I traveled there, to Omdurman, which is part of the capital, and I visited another malnutrition ward.
My name is Ahmed Khojali. That's the general medical director of Al-Buluq Hospital. It's a pediatric specialized hospital, the single hospital that has been working here.
So you have just expanded this ward?
Yeah, we've expanded this ward in the previous 2 days.
How many times have you expanded during the war?
This ward, our malnutrition ward, has been expanded 4 times.
Here, the children can get treatment, but most of the worst cases are in conflict zones hardest to reach. Both warring parties have blocked aid. That's eased a bit, not enough.
It's really quite overwhelming to walk in here because there's one long room filled with beds, two women per bed, all of them with emaciated children, and then there are a number of rooms off this one. You walk in and you see the same thing. So the sheer numbers, the sheer volume of hunger and suffering really, really hits you here.
Elsewhere in Omdurman, the hunt for food begins early. A local charity is about to serve breakfast. We're at a community kitchen here in Omdurman where around 3,000 people are fed twice a week, and they've been waiting outside since early in the morning with their buckets. Naji Abdullah is one of the men in line. I come here in hope of getting food for my children, he tells me. Then I'll go and look for whatever work I can get to earn some money to buy bread for them.
And that was Barbara Plett-Usher, Africa correspondent, reporting from Sudan. You're with the BBC World Service and live from London, this is NewsHour with me, Tim Franks. And back to our dominant story of the hour, and that is Iran's missile attack on Israel. In the evening, Israeli time, 180 missiles, which are believed to have been ballistic missiles, were fired by Iran. Most of them were intercepted. Within the last few minutes, the US President Joe Biden has said the attack appears to have been defeated and ineffective. But make no mistake, the United States is fully, fully, fully supportive of Israel. Well, we'll be returning to what the consequences of this might be, but let's also not forget the context in which it comes. It came on the day that Israel said that it has begun what it called limited ground operations inside Lebanon against the Iranian-backed Hezbollah militia. Already, Israel's strikes in Lebanon, airstrikes, may have displaced more than a million people. Among those who left their home just today was Khalid. He lives near the border in the south of the country. Why did he decide to flee?
You know, for the last year, you know, of the fight and the border, you know, this is the first time we feel that it got very serious in our village. And the first time we get a hit from aircraft right inside our village. There were a family killed, and also the priest of our village, also he was wounded, seriously wounded, along with all his family. But, you know, they didn't have any serious wounds. But, you know, this terrified the people because, you know, obviously the people, they started thinking that, you know, if somebody is wanted or they need to take out anybody, they are going to do it, whoever is there. So this is the reason why the people were very terrified. And we have decided to move.
How close is your village to the border?
It's just on the side of Khiyam village. Khiyam village is the biggest village on the border, just on the border. Half of the village, it was normally getting bombed during all this year. And the other half of the village, which is to the northern side, it was more safe. And the people, they were living there and they were still coming to our town and doing everything normally. So much people, they were still working. And ourselves also, we were still working in our village. So and normally, I think the distance is about 20 kilometers away from the border itself.
I realize this may not be an easy question to answer, but did you get a sense that there were Hezbollah positions in or around your village?
You know, normally we have been living in our area since 2006, after the last war. We haven't seen anything suspicious around us that there is positions or whatever. Of course, you see vehicles, you see people going from place to place. You can think that they are Hezbollah or they are something else, but, you know, so we were not suspicious at all, and we were very sure that there is nothing around us. And that was one of the things that happened yesterday, you know. Yesterday, the attack, it was against a family, which consists of a man and two children, his wife and his mother. And, you know, nobody has suspected them that they are fighters. This is what made the people more terrified because, you know, they could see that the victim could be a family or a priest who lives beside that family or whoever is passing on the road.
Khalid, tell me, you've moved to Beirut. Tell me just a little bit about who you are staying with and how long you think you can remain in Beirut.
I'm staying at my sister's house. She's staying with her family, and you know, I moved to her to join her. We are hoping that it will not be a long time, but you know, we just don't know. People, they are scared of the situation or what's going to happen later, what could be the future. You know, I don't know. We are really scared, Mr. Tim. I don't know.
Khalid, a resident of southern Lebanon, who fled his home today to go to Beirut. Let's pick things up with Azadeh Moaveni, professor of journalism at New York University, also veteran Middle East watcher. Azadeh, I guess in a sense, hearing his voice is just a reminder of how quickly events are now moving. Because I mean, it feels as if we're barely discussing Lebanon not long after we stopped pretty much discussing Gaza. I mean, obviously those two things are still going on, and it's all interconnected, but it is a sense of events really gathering pace today.
Yes, it seems as though theater to theater, we're looking at you know, societies that have been dealing with the specter of conflict for years, the legacy of conflict, ongoing conflict in Gaza, in southern Lebanon, Iran anticipating or looking to potentially being engulfed in this conflict as well. You know, Iran, of course, has experienced a war in living memory, the war with Iraq, almost 10 years and, you know, several hundred thousand people, you know, killed on both sides. I think that's part of why Iranians don't really see this as our war. They are very, I think most Iranians are very resentful of the prospect that their lives could be caught up, that the state has perhaps played a weak hand very badly, and has sort of driven society into the end of a cul-de-sac where, having survived a war in living memory, its legacy still felt to this day, with an economy that's really in shatters. You know, Iran has 40% inflation year after year. It's isolated. Its economy is isolated. The prospect of taking this kind of legacy, this isolated post-war reality, and then tumbling into yet another conflict is a nightmare scenario for Iranians. And they're deeply resentful. I think they see it as the humiliation and the problem of the supreme leader and of the state and not of the people.
Azadeh Moaveni, will be back with you if you can stay with us before the end of the programme. But for the time being, thank you. Let's get a view from Jerusalem now. Fleur Hassan Nahum is a special envoy for the Israeli Foreign Ministry. As I say, she's in Jerusalem. How has she seen tonight's events?
This evening has been completely unprecedented, not just because I'm in Jerusalem, and in Jerusalem normally sirens don't go off because 40% of the population of Jerusalem is Muslim, but because also this attack, as opposed to what the one in April, was quick and direct, with over 180 ballistic missiles. The last one, we kind of knew when it was landing. We knew that it was going to be 3 hours away. The Israeli Air Force was following the progression of the missiles. This time was quick missiles. And if it weren't because we have this Iron Dome technology, half the country would be destroyed right now.
Which leaves Israel where, do you think? If, as the early indications suggest, a lot of the missiles were intercepted, those perhaps that did get through were in a sense allowed to get through because they went to open land. In other words, there was relatively little damage. As I speak to you, relatively few casualties, it seems.
Yes, absolutely.
If that is the case, what do you think would be the correct response?
Well, just because we managed to defend ourselves, because we've invested so much in this type of air defense systems, it doesn't mean that the attack was any less serious. And it doesn't mean that for any normal country that receives 181 ballistic missiles from another country, it's not a declaration of war. And so Israel has to see what it does. We don't want to ever put civilians in harm's way. There's an internal debate at the moment whether we should just, you know, okay, they've done this, will this calm them down? Or whether Israel should be attacking and retaliating. But ultimately, I think the consensus in this country is that any retaliation will be towards Iranian infrastructure, not the way they do it, which is towards citizens and cities full of people.
The Iranian argument is that, look, in a sense, they had to respond to what they see as Israeli aggression, Israeli provocation. They talk about the killing of Ismail Haniyeh, the political head of Hamas in Tehran, the killing of a senior commander of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, the killing, obviously, of Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, and so on. They say that this, as far as they are concerned, was a measured response to Israeli provocation. So, in a way, the offer seems to be, we've made our displeasure clear. You know, it's a score draw now.
They started this whole thing. So the 7th of October was started by Hamas. Hamas is funded by Hezbollah. Hamas is funded by the Islamic Republic. The Islamic Republic has spent the last 20 years arming and training proxies. So they've been investing in Hamas in the south. They've been investing their biggest, of course, terrorist group, Hezbollah. They're doing the same with the Houthis. And now they've got their noses in Iraq with Shia militias now who've taken over a good part of the government. The Islamic Republic of Iran have got a clever strategy that has been working for them up until now, which is they don't get their hands dirty. They're proxy to the dirty work. All of their proxies have in their charters the destruction of the state of Israel. We're not talking about a two-state solution. We're not talking about any type of peaceful coexistence. We're talking very simply about the destruction of the state of Israel. That's Hezbollah's entire ethos. And so you could look at it and say, well, you know, Israel killed an operative. Why did Hezbollah start a war on the 8th of October? That was unprovoked, wasn't it? Wasn't the 7th of October unprovoked by Hamas? We had a ceasefire before that. And so ultimately, what we have to do is zoom out and look at the big picture. And the big picture is that the Islamic Republic of Iran is not just a threat to the state of Israel, it's a threat to the free world. They've got huge ambitions. They want to get rid of U.S. interests in the Middle East. They want to create a huge Shia homogenous caliphate. And here we are.
Okay, but Fleur, I mean, you've sort of painted a picture of Iran's evil influence over half the world. But the question remains, late in the evening, your time, Israel time, what the response should be. And you are aware that if Israel does hit back, as it has given strong indications, there is every chance that there will be further violence incoming from Iran. Is that really something that Israel wants or can afford?
We don't want any of this. We want to live in peace.
No, since understood. But given the calculations now.
Given the calculations now, the way I see it is this. If Iran is 3 months from a nuclear weapon, as we predict, should Israel wait until it has that weapon developed and they've already claimed that they want to destroy the state of Israel? Is that something responsible we should be doing to protect our citizens? I don't know. Is it?
Hassan Nahum, Special Envoy of the Israeli Foreign Ministry, speaking to me just a short while ago from Jerusalem with that rhetorical question. Well, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has delivered his own clear message. He said this evening that Iran has, in his words, made a big mistake and will pay for it. There is a live page on our website, bbc.com/news, with all the latest developments. And before the end of the programme, we'll be bringing you the perspective of a former US ambassador to Israel here on NewsHour. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC with me, Tim Franks. And back to our dominant story this hour, the Iranian missile attack on Israel. 180 cruise missiles were launched. Most of them, it seems, were intercepted. The attack, according to President Joe Biden, appears, in his words, to have been defeated and ineffective. Thomas Nides is a former US ambassador to Israel under President Biden, former Deputy Secretary of State during the Obama administration. Mr. Nides, welcome to NewsHour. The US clearly tried to signal that Iran failed in its attempts to hurt Israel. What do you anticipate may be the strength of the Israeli response?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I think it's the first and foremost we should step back and understand the following. Clearly, Israel has had, since October 7th, a series of attacks by Hezbollah into the northern part of the state of Israel, which, of course, has triggered a lot of Israelis moving to Tel Aviv and abandoning their homes, which I don't think any of us would tolerate. Obviously, Israel has done a series of attacks in Lebanon over the last week. And obviously, you just saw what has accumulated from that is an attack from Iran into Israel. At every step of this, America has been very clear that we've got Israel's back and to protect the state of Israel, given any kind of retribution that has taken place. And you saw that today. The Iranians did 180 missiles, ballistic missiles, into the state of Israel. And in coordination with the United States and Israel together, they basically shot, I think, all 180, you know, missiles either down or they fell into the fields. That's important. And America understands the importance of protecting the state of Israel. You know, obviously, we would like to de-escalate the activities, but the Iranians have clearly escalated this in a very serious way. And we'll have to determine both, first and foremost, the U.S. can determine to secure our own military, which has our own personnel in the region, to make sure that they're secure. And then we'll obviously work with Israel on determination of what the next steps are.
Yeah, but I mean, would you accept that there has, well, it feels as if there has been a change of tone, which is that absolutely the US has said from the get-go, we've got Israel's back. But they've also said, I mean, they said previously after the last, and it was at that time unprecedented, Iranian missile attack on Israel, in effect, take the win. It has been ineffective, you, Israel, occupy the higher moral and military ground. Doesn't seem to be that sort of messaging now, and I wonder if that's because the US thinks that Israel has every right to hit back hard, or because it simply can't stay Israel's hand.
Well, I think that, listen, America always takes a position of trying to de-escalate things. That's what we do, and we constantly try to attempt to do that. That said, we've been very clear. We have Israel's back. And make no mistake, Israel's decision to what they did in Lebanon and their ability to do what they believe needed to be done, part of that is they look behind their back and they realize the United States is in the Mediterranean with very large ships. So the Israel
knows. At the same time as President Biden was saying he was comfortable with it stopping in Lebanon. I mean, well, so it doesn't seem to be clear.
But to be clear, we always believe on this de-escalation. But if, in fact, the attack occurs, we're going to make sure that we protect Israel in a retaliation, which is what we've seen today in Iran. 180 ballistic missiles shot into the state of Israel is significant, and quite frankly, even more significant than the last attack by Iran. So ultimately, we have to assess what reaction there'll be both from Israel and from the United States. We'll have to assess that over the next hours and days.
Do you think there is likely to be, from your experience of and understanding of Israel, some who are close to the Prime Minister, maybe the Prime Minister himself, who will be saying, this is a moment where we can deal once and for all with Iran's nuclear program?
Listen, I'm not going to speculate on what the Prime Minister of Israel is thinking and what their security cabinet is doing. Obviously, the message that we have sent both to Iran is, don't do this. They've done it. We've also sent a message to Israel that if they do it, which they did it, we've got your back, which was proven clearly today as we assisted Israel in knocking these missiles out of the air. What happens next is going to be something in consultation with the Israelis and with the Americans. And that will play this out in the next hours and days and following.
Thomas Nides, former U.S. ambassador to Israel, thank you very much for joining us. Well, let's close with a perspective from Professor Azadeh Moaveni, veteran Middle East watcher and professor of journalism at New York University. Azadeh, Thomas Nides made the case for saying that the U.S. is always pressing for de-escalation. Do you see any off-ramp to this increasingly violent confrontation between Israel and Iran?
Well, there are certainly off-ramps that the U.S. could choose to pursue. It simply seems that there is a vacuum in Washington. The Biden presidency is absent. It has had no Iran policy, certainly, in the face of the conflagration in the region since October 7th. It has failed, refused to impose any costs and attempt to constrain Israel's response in Gaza at all. And I think sort of lost in much of the conversations we're having suddenly now about a possibility of an Iran-Israel war, lost is the reality that Iran is simply not the root cause of the conflict of the last year. Israel does prefer an isolated and belligerent Iran. A permanent enemy Iran is useful to Israel because it is a foil that allows Israel to wage a forever war and to delay and postpone having to reckon with what is the root cause of this conflict, which is reckoning with Israel's inability, unwillingness to accept a two-state solution, a one-state solution, any kind of reality in which Palestinians can live in peace with full rights and freedom alongside Israelis. Iran is part of the satellite of the regional security architecture, of course, but the core cause of the conflict that we're seeing is this, and it has been for decades. To close quickly, the U.S. has tried to bring Iran in to the fold, to give it a stake in a regional security architecture that's more balanced. Israel has opposed that. It's pressured Washington to isolate Iran, and an isolated, belligerent Iran that has no stake in regional security, that is pushed to the margins and has to cultivate proxies, is one that will behave exactly as we're seeing.
Thank you very much indeed for your words. We'll have to leave it there as we're coming to the end of the programme. But thanks for joining us, Azadeh Moaveni. That's it from NewsHour. Plenty more coverage here on the BBC World Service on the evening local time that Iran launched more than 180 missiles towards Israel. Thanks for listening.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
One of his HR team approached me and said, the chairman would like you to work in his office.
It was pretty quick that my gut instinct started to go, this is not right.
The only thing that he was interested in was touching my body.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.